For some U.S. military families living abroad, getting citizenship for their children is getting more complicated.
I've been contacted by all sorts of military members, spouses, family, who were very confused by how this was rolled out.
A lawyer helps us sort out the confusion and the reason for the new rules. In Iran, a group of environmentalists wanted to save endangered cheetahs. They were arrested, accused of being spies, and one of them died in prison. That man's son remembers his late father.
A typical tree-hugging hippie. He's someone who grew up in the wild. He loved the outdoors. He was an avid hiker, camper.
I'm Carol Hills. The Trump administration wants to lift regulations on methane. Experts say that's bad for global warming. And what does Brexit chaos look like from the rest of Europe? Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. If you grew up a military brat, it's likely that you've lived all over the country and maybe outside the U.S. or even in several different countries. That's life for American military families. Well, a policy memo released yesterday sent waves of outrage through the military community. It laid out changes to how kids of U.S. service members living overseas can obtain U.S. citizenship. The new policy takes effect October 29th, but it's so confusing and sparked such a backlash that hours after releasing it, officials with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services had to put out a clarification. David Kubot is an immigration lawyer. He's also a member of the Army National Guard. He walked us through the new policy.
So the main thing people need to know about it is that it does not impact citizenship acquisition at birth. By far, the vast majority of people who are U.S. citizens in this country acquire their citizenship at birth. The next largest category of people who become citizens in the United States get it through naturalization. And then there's a small fraction of people who acquire citizenship automatically after they are born through the naturalization or residence of one of their parents. And this is what that memo primarily affects.
To clarify it, give us an example of someone this new policy might affect.
Sure. So a direct example would be a U.S. service member who's living overseas, who's not yet a citizen, who's a permanent resident, and has children living with him or her who are themselves permanent residents. If that service member were to naturalize and become a citizen, those children would automatically become citizens because even though they're living outside the United States, the USCIS used to consider living outside the United States with a U.S. service member or government employee to be the same as living inside the United States.
And so as of October 29th, under this new policy, how will that change?
That will change because they'll either have to apply for naturalization for those children to actually become citizens themselves, which is an application, not an automatic acquisition of citizenship, or that parent would have to move back to the United States with those children, at which point the acquisition of citizenship would happen automatically as long as it happened before the child turned 18.
Now that these children have to apply to become naturalized citizens, is there a chance that they can be turned down, or is this new rule a formality?
I wouldn't say it's a formality. Anytime you include an application in a process instead of an automatic acquisition, there's a potential for somebody to make a mistake in the paperwork or not file it on time or do something in the interim that causes the case to be denied or delayed. Where it becomes a problem is where that child thinks they're a citizen the whole time, comes back to the United States, never applies, and then does something that might affect their permanent residency, and then later finds out they were never a citizen. And that, unfortunately, does occur. It's not that it's not a burden for the people that it affects. It's a very small population. But for those people, it's a very big deal.
President Trump has stated very clearly that he's looking at revoking birthright citizenship. How can this not be seen as a first step toward gutting the rights of people applying for citizenship?
And that's the part that I think is probably the most difficult about this. A lot of people had that particular take when this news came out. However, it doesn't implicate the rules of birthright citizenship, which themselves are very complicated. This did not in any way, shape, or form affect those rules or requirements. So it's not clear that this is the first step on a line of reinterpretations that might have some impact in that way.
But it does set a tone, though. I mean, it does set a tone and suggests that the current administration wants to scrutinize more carefully who's becoming a citizen.
Well, certainly it would be more helpful if they were more expansive in their viewpoint than less expansive. What I'm not prepared to say is that it's going to necessarily lead to some new step that isn't implicated by this memo.
David, you serve in the National Guard. You're a member of the military. How do you respond to this kind of new rule?
Well, I think that the way that it was rolled out was deeply confusing, and it would have been much better if they clarified from the beginning exactly who this applied to and exactly who it did not apply to. I've been contacted by all sorts of military members, spouses, family, who were very confused by how this was rolled out. However, the actual impact to it is relatively minimal, and there are some things that we can do to improve immigrants and military families of immigrants that I think are more impactful than we're being worried about this particular policy.
That was David Kubot, an immigration lawyer who served in the Army National Guard for the last 12 years. When we talk about greenhouse gases that cause climate change, the number one culprit is CO2. But right alongside carbon dioxide is methane. It's the main ingredient in natural gas. It's also a contributor to climate change, and in terms of the damage caused by each ton of gas, methane is worse than CO2. It traps more heat in the atmosphere and lingers for much longer. That's why the Obama administration put regulations in place to cut down on the amount of methane that gas companies release into the air. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency said it wants to get rid of those regs. Climate experts worry that's a bad idea.
If they're successful at what they're trying to do, then we'll not only be foregoing an opportunity to slow the rate of global warming, but we'll be making the situation worse.
Matt Watson is with the Environmental Defense Fund, a nonprofit advocacy group.
Methane emissions actually occur up and down the oil and gas supply chain, from the drilling process on the front end all the way through transport and delivery to end use.
Tell us what Obama had changed about methane emissions, and so therefore what's being pulled back.
One of the centerpieces of that rule was a requirement that oil and gas companies simply go out and look for leaks and fix them in a timely fashion. So the Trump administration has actually proposed two rules. Several months back, they proposed a first rule that weakened the provisions of that 2016 rule. And what they've proposed today is to completely eliminate the regulation of methane. And, you know, some in industry like to say that because it's their product, they have an economic interest in reducing leakage and putting methane in the pipeline. But clearly that's not true, or we wouldn't see the industry emitting roughly 13 million tons of methane through leaks and venting year after year.
But isn't it also true that energy companies kind of tout the environmental benefits of natural gas? All I get are mailings from gas companies to switch to gas.
Our abundant natural gas is already saving us money, producing cleaner electricity.
As our most efficient fuel source.
That's where America's safely recovering more than a century's worth of clean natural gas.
They do, and companies with a long-term view understand that methane emissions are their Achilles heel. The current science indicates that methane leakage from the oil and gas supply chain obliterates most, if not all, of the climate advantage that natural gas can have over coal. So you have a set of companies out there that understand that this is a problem and that it threatens their long-term economic viability. And in fact, a handful of companies have come out in strong opposition to what the Trump administration is doing. And some of those companies have called on the Trump administration not only to preserve the current rules, but to expand and strengthen them.
It's interesting you mentioned the big energy and gas companies. We reached out to ExxonMobil, and they issued the following comment on the new rule that Trump just issued. We will continue to urge the EPA to retain the main features of the existing methane rule. Why do ExxonMobil and BP and others disagree with Trump's change in this?
Companies that are taking a long-term view of their future, see that the world is getting serious about climate change, and know that methane is a problem they have to get a handle on. They understand that natural gas is not going to have a role to play in the transition to a clean energy economy if they don't fix this methane problem.
So will dropping these Obama-era regulations, will it take effect immediately?
has to go through a regulatory process to be finalized. We also believe that what they're attempting to do is unlawful.
Is the Environmental Defense Fund your employer? Are they planning to file suit?
We are considering that option.
Matt Watson is an energy specialist with the Environmental Defense Fund. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Sure thing.
It's one of those comebacks that nobody really wanted. Europe is witnessing a dramatic surge in measles. Four European countries, once considered free of the highly infectious disease, are seeing it return. That's according to data released by the World Health Organization today. Public health officials say the reasons why vary from country to country, but one major problem is misinformation about vaccines. There's plenty of that all over the internet. And social media companies have been trying to clamp down. Pinterest is one of them. This week, the company said it will direct users only to vaccine-related material from reputable public health organizations such as WHO. Ifeoma Ozoma is Pinterest's public policy and social impact manager. I asked her what kind of vaccine misinformation was on the platform.
What we were seeing was the largest amount of misinformation was about measles, mumps, and rubella, the flu vaccine, and the HPV vaccines. And many of the purveyors of the anti-vaccine misinformation were relying heavily on compelling visual imagery, as well as scare tactics about children in order to get people to go onto their sites where they either have ad farms, so they're making money off of people clicking to their site, or they're selling products that they claim are better than vaccines. And so there are many resources for people to go to from the WHO and the CDC and others, but they don't tend to be as compelling as the imagery that the misinformation purveyors create.
So kind of shiny things are attracting people, and the shiny things around vaccines are coming from people you've determined are putting out misinformation.
That's right. Shiny and scary. And so they're compelling, especially for people like parents who happen to be on our platform doing what most people come to our platform for, which is planning things around their life and using us as a visual search engine. But then they're on the platform and they decide to also look for information that's top of mind for them, like a vaccine schedule or the flu vaccine or MMR.
Other social media platforms are also taking steps to clamp down on vaccine misinformation, but you're getting a lot more praise than they are. What are you doing differently than the other platforms?
Well, we believe that working directly with organizations like the WHO is incredibly important because as an online platform, we are not health experts and they are. And in addition, what we are doing differently is making sure that we're not showing vaccine misinformation alongside the resources from these public health experts, because we believe it creates what is essentially a false equivalency when you're given a link to legitimate information, but it's right next to or on top of or below misinformation.
There are critics who say that only allowing information from select sources is a kind of censorship. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Well, we're taking this approach because we believe that people always have the right and ability to use other platforms. But in addition, on our platform, we do not have the responsibility to distribute content that we believe is harmful on behalf of people who may find it engaging for whatever reason.
Now, your new search feature around vaccines, it's now available to users globally, but only in English. Do you plan to roll it out in other languages as well?
Absolutely. We're hoping to. And one of the things we're most excited about working with the WHO is that they are working in a number of countries around the world and in over 23 languages. And so we hope to expand by working with experts in those markets, in those languages, to make sure that we're getting this out to as many folks as possible.
Ifeoma Ozoma is the Public Policy and Social Impact Manager at Pinterest. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me today.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Mangroves are important nesting sites for hundreds of bird species. They provide breeding grounds for fish, shrimp, and oysters. They're also crucial for slowing down the process of climate change. But worldwide, thousands of acres of mangroves have disappeared because of drought and human activity. For the past 10 years, one of the world's largest mangrove reforestation projects has been quietly restoring the mangroves of southern Senegal. The BBC's Louise Dewast reports.
In a stretch of land between the Gambia and Guinea-Bissau, the Casamance River runs westward, flanked by corridors of luscious green mangroves. But it wasn't always like this here.
We're getting on a boat now and heading deep into the mangroves with environmentalist Aidar El Ali. He's going to show us some of the reforestation that they've been working on here and show us and tell us why these mangroves are so important.
Look, here we have a leaf that exhales salt. And you see, this is salt taken from the water. These trees regulate the level of salinization in the delta. And because the rice fields are nearby, if the mangrove is healthy and regulates this environment, then the fields are fertile. But if the mangroves disappear, the level of salt increases and the rice fields die.
Ali is at the head of an NGO called Oceanium. Much of the reforestation here has been funded by a carbon finance initiative, multinational companies who hope to make money from capturing thousands of tons of CO2. But Ali, previously Senegal's Minister for the Environment, is passionate about reforestation. He's already replanted a surface larger than Paris.
I think we have a lot to catch up on. If we had started in the 80s, today we would have replanted thousands and thousands of trees. We have planted 15,000 hectares or 150 million propagules in more than 400 villages. So we've done a lot, but it is not enough. We need to do more and more and more.
Because of their unique way of regulating saltwater levels, mangroves are crucial for agriculture and fishing. That's why local people have been actively involved in the project. Just outside the main city of Zingishore, we meet Yaya Diata, a farmer. There are new rice fields next to replanted mangroves, and Diata is hoping to produce rice here for the first time.
Reforestation has worked, even on a social level. I am respected by my community because of the work we've done. It's helped local populations. It's going to help future generations. I feel that I've overcome my misfortunes.
Like many here, Diata and his family also depend on fishing, and for that, too, mangroves are crucial.
If we didn't have this mangrove, the fish would be much farther away. This is what enables the fish to reproduce, to multiply. And these leaves, they act as fertilizers. For the fish that I catch, some of it is for my family and the rest is for sale. It also creates employment for my wife who sells the fish.
But about 30 minutes away in Siginar, things are very different. Replantation efforts have failed here, and young people from the village, like Landry Djedou, are left with little to eat and little to do.
In front of us here, all of that, it used to be rice fields. Our parents used to farm here and there was a lot of rice. But now the water is full of salt and we haven't been able to stop that.
A quarter of the total estimated surface area of mangroves in Senegal have been lost since the 70s. Reasons for the degradation are multiple: drought, roads being built, overfishing and illegal logging.
Today, what's left? Well, it's the desert.
That's Jacob Colley. He's the local representative of the government agency that's responsible for protected marine areas.
Our main goal is to safeguard the fish stock
and try and prevent people from fishing recklessly. We've started installing signs that indicate where fishing is banned. From the main road, you can't see, but when you go inside the mangroves, it's a disaster over there.
Colley says that his agency has plans to replant trees themselves, 500 hectares over the next 5 years, but he's not sure it will be enough to protect these precious forests for future generations.
The BBC's Louise Douast, reporting from the mangrove forests of Senegal. Twitter can be a nasty place, but it's not always the case. Mivan Babacar was a child when her Kurdish family fled Iraq during the first Gulf War. They stayed in a refugee camp in the Netherlands for 5 years in the 1990s. Now, as a 29-year-old, Mivan still holds on to a memory of an act of kindness from one adult at the camp. She went to Twitter to help find him, and for once, the Twitter sphere came through. Here's Mivan's story.
One thing that somebody did that has stayed with me, there's a guy who worked there who was nameless to me, who gave me a bike as a gift. It stayed with me for several reasons. It's rare that you get a gift as a child refugee, like number one. Second, I think when I saw it, I thought that it was such a big gift. I think I thought that I didn't deserve such a huge thing. I think that knowing that somebody else who I respected and loved thought that I did deserve it, eventually that feeling became the basis of how I felt about myself, that actually I did deserve good things, and I did deserve things that maybe I thought were too good for me. And I think that that feeling of being special and valued in that way is one that not only refugee children should have, but every child should have. And for me, that was that moment. And I wanted to find this man again and to thank him for that moment and for those lessons that he taught me in that moment. I think I still kind of don't believe that it all happened. It was very exciting. It was so wonderful to think that not only did he remember me, but he also wanted to meet me. He actually didn't live in the Netherlands anymore. He lived in Germany. And so we drove to Germany. And so I knocked on his door and he opened it and I said hello, and we had a great big hug, and he invited me inside for some tea. You know, he's been working with refugees since the 90s and has worked all over the world helping people get their lives back in order and doing it all incredibly humbly and quietly. When I posted that original tweet, a couple hours later, I had two refugees reach out to me and previous refugees and tell me that actually they had also received help from him and his wife. And I just believe that there are so many wonderful people out there who do stuff like this that just aren't celebrated enough.
Mivan Babacar telling the story of how she reunited with a man she only named as Egbert. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. An 11-year-old wannabe musician from Sierra Leone tracks down his music idol in London.
James Brown, I stalked him for 3 years. Really, that's really it. You know, anything you want in life, you have to be persistent and consistent.
Now Michael Mwenso is living in New York and fronting his own band. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Frustrated Brits had a few things to get off their chests today.
Stop the king! Stop the king! Stop the king!
Protesters gathered outside Parliament in London and in cities across the UK. The coup they want to stop is Prime Minister Boris Johnson's maneuver to stop lawmakers from meeting ahead of a crucial deadline for Brexit. Meanwhile, European foreign ministers met in Helsinki, Finland today. The agenda was climate change, but the BBC's Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus says what they really wanted to talk about was Brexit.
They wanted to hear from the UK ministers here about that decision that's just happened in London to suspend Parliament. So what we heard was the ministers of the EU ministers on the way in saying that they were going to be quizzing their UK counterparts on how is this going to play out, was the question they said. What's the timetable? What's the plan? How is this going to work? Because nobody on the EU side really knows at the minute.
Do they take this as sort of a whole new thing to consider in negotiating any deal with the UK, or are they just bemused by the whole thing?
Well, I think it's a whole new sort of dynamic that in an already very complicated and tense and fraught process, and one that nobody can predict how it's going to turn out. Now, I think this adds a whole layer of complications for the EU because they have indicated, of course, in the last few weeks that they want to engage with the new Prime Minister in the UK, with Boris Johnson. They've asked him to come forward with new proposals for the bits of the deal that he doesn't like. But now what they're facing is a situation where if they negotiate a deal with him, it's going to have to get through the UK Parliament. But the UK Parliament isn't going to be sitting for the next 5-6 weeks. So there's going to be a very, very short window of just a handful of days later in October if they can reach a deal to get it through. So this, I think, adds to the sense in the EU side, and we heard this from ministers arriving, that the chances of a deal are looking very dicey.
So from what you're saying, it looks like EU leaders are open to hearing something new from Boris Johnson.
Yes, definitely. And they said that to him over the weekend in the G7 summit in Biarritz. And before that, the couple of days before that, we heard Mr. Johnson went and visited Paris and Berlin. And he heard from the German chancellor, the French president. And again, we heard from the EU ministers meeting here today. They said, you know, the UK has to come up with some new ideas. They're really willing to hear it. But those things have to satisfy the basic EU demands, which is no change on the island of Ireland, no threat to the peace process in Ireland, something that can deal with that. They're not just going to simply strike out the bits of the agreement that Boris Johnson doesn't like.
Just how damaging would a no deal be to the European countries?
Well, it would impact different countries to a different extent. So the countries with the closest trading ties to the UK, so essentially the geographically closest one, so France just across the channel, you've got Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, the economies that trade a lot with the UK, expect that they would take a serious hit. But the EU certainly is very clear. It thinks that the effects will be far greater on the UK side, because where something, I think, like 10-15% of EU trade goes to the UK, about 40-50% of the UK's trade is with the EU.
What's the next critical date for Europe? I mean, what's the next step in their kind of jockeying around this whole Brexit thing?
Well, I think it's the coming week. So next week is now absolutely critical, because that is going to be the week when Parliament is still sitting in the UK, and Parliament may make some moves in a direction to try to tie Boris Johnson's hands. That's what they're talking about, to demand that he pass legislation to demand that he, in no way does he take the UK out of the EU with no deal, no arrangements. But if Parliament is sent home, you know, in early September, then the key date becomes mid-October, the I think 16th, 17th is the critical moment. That is the meeting of the summit of EU leaders. At that point, Parliament will have returned. Any deal that is struck between the UK and the EU will be approved. And then it has 10 days or so to get through the parliaments on both sides to get all of the ends tied up.
The BBC's Europe correspondent, Damian Grammaticus, speaking to us from Helsinki, where he seems to be serenaded by some music there. Thanks a lot, Damian.
It's a pleasure.
There are currently 8 environmentalists on trial in Iran. They were arrested about a year ago and accused of spying. They all worked on a project to save a critically endangered animal. But that simple goal turned into a nightmare for them and their families. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Listen carefully, because we might not hear this sound in the wild for much longer. This is the Asiatic cheetah, a species on the brink of extinction. Scientists say there are fewer than 50 of them left in the wild, and they live in eastern and central Iran.
And it is different from the African cheetah, which we all know from documentaries. It chases gazelles on the grassy plains of the Serengeti, but in Iran, cheetahs survive in rocky desert terrain, in island mountains, where they are hunting desert sheep.
Franz Lantik photographed the rare cheetahs 8 years ago when he went to Iran on assignment for National Geographic. In one of Lantik's photos, the cheetah looks directly at the camera. Its huge, brown, piercing eyes are breathtaking.
it is impossible to see the cheetahs with your own eyes. I worked there with one of the rangers in one of the reserves who said that he'd been trying to understand the cheetahs for 30 years, but he'd only seen them 15 times in 30 years.
In 2008, alarmed by the dwindling numbers of the Asiatic cheetahs in Iran, a group of environmentalists started an NGO. The Persian Wildlife Heritage Foundation's mission was to study the cheetahs and to find ways to protect them. Scientists used something called a camera trap to track and monitor the animals.
It's a very simple tool. It's a camera that is activated by something that passes by. It sends out an infrared signal, and then the image is recorded on the camera.
Lantic says these cameras are manufactured in the U.S., which might have played a role in what happened next. Early last year, the Iranian government began arresting members of the Persian Wildlife Heritage Foundation, among them Ramin Sayed Emami's father.
My father is like a typical tree-hugging hippie. He's someone who grew up in the wild. He loved the outdoors. His whole life, he was an avid, a hiker, camper.
Qaboos Sayed Emami studied sociology in the U.S., then returned to Iran and later co-founded the Persian Wildlife Heritage Foundation.
This was something that was very dear to him, preserving the environment for the next generations, preserving the wildlife.
International organizations like the United Nations got involved with the Cheetah Preservation Project in Iran. Panthera, a big cat conservation group based in New York, sent some technical help. Ramin says his father knew that the Iranian government is notoriously suspicious of any foreign involvement in the country, so his father played it by the book. He got permission from the Ministry of Environment, Ramin says, and he was transparent about his work. But in January last year, the 64-year-old was summoned to the police station.
And when he went to the police station, they just threw a bag over his head and took him away.
Ramin says his father called home the next day, said he was in jail, but it was just a misunderstanding. He would be released soon.
Until 2 weeks later, as we were left in the dark, not knowing what to do, until we got a phone call that my father had passed away in prison.
Officials said he had taken his own life, but Ramin doesn't accept this. A branch of the Iranian armed forces accused Sayed Emami and other environmentalists of spying for the U.S. and Israel. Those cameras they installed to track the cheetahs, the security forces accused them of using them to collect sensitive information about military sites.
To this day, they have yet to present a single source of evidence. I mean, it's ludicrous when you look at the accusations and claims.
And there's something else that might have angered the Iranian authorities, says Franz Lantic, the National Geographic photographer. He says Panthera, the conservation group in New York, the one that sent technical assistance to the NGO in Iran.
The founder of that group, an American hedge fund billionaire named Thomas Kaplan, went on record in 2017 with very strong anti-Iran views.
Panthera didn't respond to my questions about this. Meanwhile, more than 300 scientists from all over the world signed a letter urging the supreme leader of Iran to release the 8 remaining environmentalists. Cole Burton, who's a conservationist at the University of British Columbia, signed the letter. And he says the arrests in Iran have had a chilling effect on wildlife research and preservation in the region.
We're really like detectives trying to understand what's going on with little bits and pieces of information. So I think it's quite problematic. I mean, we don't really know what's happening if we're not able to observe and collect data on these animals.
Burton has used similar cameras to study bears in Armenia. 2 of his students, Iranian Canadians, were planning to expand that research into Iran. He says those plans have now been cancelled. Ramin Sayed Emami, whose father died in prison, is a musician. He now lives in the U.S. Last year, he released a music video in memory of his father. It's called But You're Not Here, and it speaks of loss and longing. Ramin says his mother is stuck in Iran. Authorities have banned her from leaving the country. And as for the 8 environmentalists, their trials are ongoing. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Colombians woke up to some troubling news today.
Anunciamos al mundo que ha comenzado la segunda Marquetalia.
That's from a video put out by Ivan Marquez, a former leader of the FARC rebel group, and he's calling on his followers to take up arms. Less than 3 years ago, the FARC signed a peace agreement that ended more than 50 years of civil war in Colombia. Fernando Kutz was a U.S. advisor in the peace process in 2016. He's also a former director for South America at the White House for Presidents Obama and Trump. Fernando, what can you tell us about this ex-FARC leader, Ivan Marquez?
Ivan Marquez was certainly an important figure, both for the FARC itself, of course, as one of their key leaders and key dignitaries as well, who would represent actively the FARC internationally. But he was also a key figure for the peace process. He was one of the chief negotiators. He was very involved in the negotiations. He was very public and involved when the deal was actually struck and a peace agreement was reached. So this is a very significant moment to have him this publicly turning on this whole process.
Has he said why he is turning against the process and calling for people to take up arms?
He did. He cited specific examples of individuals that have been killed. And as he said, the government, he didn't accuse the government of being behind that, but he said that the government turned a blind eye and was indifferent to the deaths of former FARC members. But, you know, I suspect that there's more to it than that. I think there's been a real difficulty on the part of everybody to figure out how to fold former FARC members back into the economy. How do you make them into productive citizens in the illicit economy, when a lot of these folks have lived their entire lives in the jungle with guns? That's kind of all they know.
What did the peace deal that was struck in 2016 actually say, and did it address the economic issues that you're talking about?
Well, it tried to, but it is very controversial. Part of the problem is that in Colombia, if you talk to the average Colombian citizen, they would say, well, you know, yes, we probably need to spend some money to help these former FARC individuals, to help train them, to help educate them, to help integrate them into society and provide jobs for them. But when there are millions of victims out there, Colombians who have suffered at the hands of these individuals, how can we prioritize giving money to the perpetrators instead of giving money to the victims? So it becomes this controversy where many Colombians are fundamentally opposed to helping the former FARC members in any way, which makes this whole process a lot harder. I think everybody knows deep down that unless you help the former FARC members and unless you provide them with economic opportunities, they won't have much of a choice but to go back to some sort of illicit means. And I think, unfortunately, we're seeing that play out to an extent today.
For the uninitiated, how would you explain the FARC rebel group and its relationship with Colombia?
The FARC group has been around for many, many decades, and they are, according to the U.S. government and many others, they are a terrorist organization. They were fundamentally opposed to the government in the regions that they controlled. They controlled quite a bit of territory in their heyday. And while they were originally founded as a means to stand up for workers' rights and to counter poverty and to kind of look out for the forgotten rural folks, they became more of a pretty well-oiled machine and an operation that both controlled and ran large swaths of coca country, essentially, you know, a narco-trafficking organization in many ways. They certainly evolved over their decades of existence, and it's unclear exactly what they want to evolve into now with this new iteration that Marquez is calling for today.
Fernando Kutz is former director for South America under Presidents Obama and Trump. He was also a U.S. advisor in the peace process in 2016 with the FARC that's now been breached. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Colombia's President Iván Duque condemned leaders of the FARC today. He said he's offering a $1 million reward for the arrest of each of them. He also accused Venezuelan President Nicolás Maduro of providing safe haven to the FARC rebels. The music of Muenzo and the Shakes. To say it's pretty wild is an understatement. Part jazz, part Broadway, part funk, and elements of German cabaret. You know, it sounds crazy. But as you'll soon hear, Michael Muenzo says they aim to combine art and performance. So you mean.
Be careful what you wish for.
Michael Muenzo spoke to the world's Marco Werman recently. They talked music, art, and, yep, James Brown.
No, no, no.
Michael Mwenso joins us from New York. Your music is wonderful, and it seems to kind of follow this path that your life has traced. It's a path that kind of makes up a map of sorts of the African diaspora from Freetown in Sierra Leone, where you were born, to the colonial power London, and then to New York and the States, which obviously has its own cultural role in the music you gravitate to. How much is that kind of path, that route you've taken, how much is that on your mind during the creative process?
I think it's more in the spirit, you know. I think, you know, you are a passport of everywhere you've been. You are an identity of everywhere you've been. Every place you've lived in the world must also be part of your spirit. Not so much your mind, but your spirit and your soul. And definitely in the music you hear, and thank you for liking the music. In the music that you hear, you're exactly correct. You're hearing all of the places that my spirit dwelt. And you're hearing the experiences that one had in them, whether it is West Africa, whether it is London, whether it is now the United States. The life has been all informed by where the spirit has gone to. So you are correct.
When did music become so important in your life?
I think when we moved to London, when my mother got married and then he passed away, and that was a very traumatic experience for her and me. And that was a period of time when we were separated, me and my mother. And I was living with almost, he was like a father to me, a gentleman that was my godfather, really. And he had this incredible collection of vinyl records that were all the whole span of black music, Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong, Ray Charles. And the music just started to be to help this lonely child, you know, who's missing his mother and wishes he knew his father. You know, the music became sort of a counselor, sort of a friend. And then I just kind of developed more into it, and then allowed myself to also kind of experience myself in it by seeing them and getting to know some of them.
And that was in London when you moved there?
That was in London, yeah. 11, 12 years old, yeah.
So I know somewhere in the middle of all of this in London, you came into the orbit of Wynton Marsalis and also James Brown. There is a video clip where you are dancing on stage at a James Brown gig. How did that happen?
James Brown, I stalked him for 3 years. Really, that's really it. You know, anything you want in life, you have to be persistent and consistent. So James Brown, I don't know what happened. Like 11 years old, he just took over my life. And then it was a tape. I was in boarding school, and it just happened, and I just went crazy. And then he came. He was, you know, I saw him. He said I was cute, and then that was it. Next year he came, same thing. Nice to meet you, son. Third time I said to my mom, we're going to go to the airport and meet the band so we can get him at the sound check, because I had to get to know him, and I wanted him to see the talent I had. And it happened. You know, at the sound check, I bamboozled him and then, you know, shocked him. And then he allowed me to come on stage for the next few years.
How did you shock him? Did you just show him a few dance moves? In the video, you are on fire.
Well, he was at the sound check and he's playing the organ. You know, he thinks he can play organ. And then I went up to him and how I would get some of the older musicians. You start naming stuff they don't think anybody knows. So he did some albums in the 60s. One of them is called Devil's Den. So I said to him, I bet you can't remember Devil's Den. He said, what? What do you know about that? So I started to play. Then he kicked me off. He said, you don't know what you're doing, son. And then, you know, he starts conducting the band. I think he's forgotten about me. And then he points to me to do a solo. I play. He stops the band. He says, what's your name again? I said, Michael Mwenso. What did you say his name was? And I calmed down. I said, I could do the splits, too. I did two splits. Boom, boom. He said, what? What do you want to sing? Give it up, turn it loose. One, two, three, four. I start doing the splits, twists, singing, all kinds of stuff. He starts the band and says, you got a suit? I said, yes, sir. You're coming on stage tonight. And then that was it. And then from then, he allowed me for like, till I got too tall, because, you know, he's like 5'6". So, you know, when I started getting too tall, he was like, son, it's not cute anymore. But for the, you know, for those years of knowing him and having the privilege to go on stage and witness him, you know, was I think, molded me for my adulthood, you know, for the rest of my life to get to know someone like that, you know.
And now with your band, The Shakes, you're rooted in New York City. If one can think of your work with The Shakes as kind of a distillation of everything you've done so far, describe your band in that context for us. I mean, because there's kind of a Sly and the Family Stone vibe to it.
We have
And that's a compliment, by the way.
No, I know it is. Listen. Don't even start me on Sly and the Family Stone. No, we have three values as The Shakes we try and do. We're trying to deal with one, a musical presentation that deals with the whole history of black music. Two, a spiritual message that deals with empowerment and belief. And three, stage presentation that deals with theater and drama and vaudeville. So we're just trying to really deal with those free values of art and performance and trying to elevate them to even higher and wider kind of streams of what we have seen before. You know, we want you to be able to see Earth, Wind & Fire, James Brown, Duke Ellington, Frank Zappa all on the same stage. You know, we want to be able to extend that trajectory of what has been done before through all of those different vehicles of presentation, whether it's vaudeville, cabaret, et cetera, but we want to add the spiritual message, which is saying, know the God and you know regrets. All these songs are about believing in yourself. And, you know, we want to be able to play in a freak, frenetic way that deals with jazz, funk, rhythm and blues, African rhythms, et cetera, et cetera.
Michael Mwenso of the group Mwenso and the Shakes, thanks so much. Great to meet you.
You're wonderful. Thank you. Oh, wow. Devil's Den.
Devil's Den.
Wow.
Our engineer, quick on the draw.
That was quick. Wow. That's deep. Thank you. Lovely to have met you.
You too, Michael. All the
all
best.
Right now.
Bye-bye.
Our engineer there surprising Michael Mwenso and Marco Werman with a little James Brown. Mwenso and the Shakes' new album is called Emergence. That's our program for today. A special thanks and best wishes to Patrick Cox, a 20-year veteran of our program. Patrick, we thank you for years of reporting and editing that brought fresh voices to the world, and we wish you well. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.